This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, the translation from quality tool to eating more healthily and more responsibly is pretty stark. And I found that people have come back and told me that it's been a life-changing experience.
Today on Sea Change Radio, I speak with a craftsman who makes razor-sharp kitchen knives and with a progressive political talk show host who relies on razor-sharp analysis. First, knife maker extraordinaire Adam Simha gives us a glimpse into the world of high-end kitchen blades. We talk about how having fine knives can help you savor life more and be less wasteful at the same time. Then I talk with political analyst and talk show host David Pakman about the 2016 election and review the environmental positions of candidates on both sides of the aisle. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Adam Simha. He is the founder of MKS Knife, and folks can go to mksdesign.com to check out his work. Adam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Well, you do some amazing stuff with knives. First, why don't you explain your journey to becoming a knife maker?
Well, thank you. I had been making metal furniture for a number of years. First out of necessity and then out of compulsion. And I took a bladesmithing class, this is the late 90s now, and found myself once again hooked. Fire and electricity and respect and understanding for materials and process that was new to me and an amazing journey, one that one never steps off.
So Adam, Sea Change Radio is mostly about environmental issues and sustainability. Why is knife making a sustainability issue in your mind?
Well, on several levels, I would say, in my case, since most of the majority of what I do is culinary, making things for people that they will be paying a lot more for than they might otherwise had they gone to a store, but will consequently value more and care for more and use more. So that means that they will be cooking more at home, thinking more about what they're eating and what they're buying. And all of that going towards consuming less and taking more time and more care about the things that they are consuming. And also that knife that they have invested in, they're going to invest in taking care of. If you think about every time you take your knife to get sharpened, more than likely, there is an amount of material being taken off of that knife that is as much as would wear off in years of use. So if you take care of it yourself at home, you're going to reduce that by the factor of 50. I mean, literally, that when you bring it to get it sharpened, it doesn't need much. Means that knife could very easily last you the rest of your life.
And how often does one have to sharpen your knife compared to other knives?
If you maintain it, which will take you literally 12 seconds a day, you should have it sharpened maybe every 4 to 6 months. And even
professionally or?
Yeah, professionally. Just a quick aside, if you have a stainless knife, you want to use an abrasive hone, which is shaped the same as a traditional butcher's steel, which is what you'd get in your set of knives. But it is actually abrasive. You're shaving off the little bent over bits of steel that from the edge of your knife that are worn, as opposed to trying to bend them back into line. And if you use that every 3 days and something like a leather strap, which might seem a little exotic, but it really isn't, and I send one out with every one of my knives that I do, it's the old barbershop thing. You see the traditional picture of the barber stropping his straight razor.
That really helps.
It really does. What it does is it grabs the little microscopic burr, the burr being the bit of the knife edge that's bent over from use, and tears it off if it's small enough.
Hmm.
And if it's not small enough, then your abrasive hone will take care of it. So that sort of maintenance is really on the 10 to 12 second a day range.
And that can make a big difference.
Huge difference, yeah. I mean, I see knives come in for sharpening that have chips, visible chips in them that I have to grind past. And the amount of material I have to remove is just ridiculous compared to a knife that's been well maintained, but needs a sharpening, barely have to do anything.
It would seem that somebody who invests a little bit more in their knife or their knife collection would be more inclined to eat at home, which is in an age where we're throwing away more and more food, particularly in restaurants, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. And the data that I have is anecdotal, but it is from practically every person that I have made a custom knife for, that they don't feel the need to have a motley collection. They have one, maybe two, and they're invested in taking care of it and really love to have it around and love to use it. And so they make a point of using it more, and they think about what they're going to be cooking and the fact that spending more money on less, say, meat or quality fish is well worth it in the grand scheme of things. And it's also more of a pleasure to cook and eat. You know, the translation from quality tool to eating more healthily and more responsibly is pretty stark. And I found that people have come back and told me that it's been a life-changing experience.
So if you go to a Bed Bath & Beyond or a place like that, Williams-Sonoma, you're going to see the big brands are Wusthof, Global, Schön.
Right, yep.
Oh, and Henkel's.
Yep.
As a consumer, if you weren't making knives, if you had to choose one of those type of mass-produced knives, which company are you a little more partial to?
So the German companies are old. The Japanese, the Schön and the Global are newer, but coming in part from different Japanese traditions. I would say a lot of it comes down to subjective personal choice. I mean, these things are all pretty much on par. I generally don't like to talk out of school about any one particular brand, but the Japanese style of knife is just a very different beast and comes from a different culinary tradition. So the expectations are different. So I think for someone looking for that knife that they want to spend less than $200 for, maybe even less than $100, there are a number of choices, and everyone has their own style, and some people have some training, some people don't. So, you know, if you like a light knife, then you're probably going to look more towards the Japanese, and if you want something more hefty, you'll look more towards the Germans, and there's plenty of stuff in between. You know, there are American-made, American-styled knives, all clad. Again, full disclosure, I designed this line. Those are available at Bloomingdale's, and the whole point of that process was to design an American knife, because just as the knife industry came from guys coming from Germany, from France, and from Italy, and from England, and working in factories here, bringing their own slightly different versions of the traditions with them, so is our culinary tradition, this grand conglomerate of things, and there isn't just one way of doing things.
So you're talking about how there's this real difference in the traditions of producing the German versus the Japanese knives, but paint us a picture of the process and maybe how yours differs.
So one way or another, you'll start with a piece of steel and heat that in some sort of an oven, whether it's a giant gas forge or a coal forge, or, you know, these days using an induction heater to the point where it is glowing orange. You know, that's hotter than red, but not as hot as yellow. And hammer that now soft, glowing thing into shape using a hammer or a giant power hammer, which is a huge mechanical contraption, or a thing called a drop forge, which was just a giant weight that would drop literally onto this glowing orange piece of steel and smash it into the form of your knife.
So is that steel itself a part of your selection process, or is steel steel?
No, absolutely. It's crucial to pick something that is appropriate and of very high quality. If you start with great ingredients, you can make a fantastic meal. And if you know, but there's a lot more to it than that. But you do have to start with something great to begin with. On the most basic level, the steel has to have a minimum amount of carbon in order to be able to be made hard enough to take an edge. So the kind of steel that your paperclip is made out of could never be made into a good knife.
Six-blade knife, do anything for you. Oh, anything you wanna do. One blade breaking my heart. One blade tearing your body. Six-blade knife, do anything for you.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to knife maker and the founder of MKS Knife, Adam Simha. And just to give our listeners a little better idea, why don't you give us a kind of an overview of your production and your volume?
Well, I don't produce too much. I would say between 2 and 5 knives a week on a good week.
It takes hours and hours to make one knife, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, that goes up in a nonlinear way as it gets bigger, for sure.
And your knives can be like a small paring knife is like $150, and your higher end knives are close to $600. Is that right?
Yeah, so it all depends on the trim and any sort of special things. The majority of what I do is custom these days, although I started out doing a line of knives with bicycle handles that whose parts I had made outside. And so that was the $150 paring knife and a $220 chef's knife. And at the time, that was pushing it in terms of price. Now that's sort of firmly in the middle. So a custom paring knife might cost you $250, an oyster knife, the same. Something in the middle might be like a boning knife, or a slicer might be in the $400 to $500 range, and a chef's could range from $600 to $900, depending on whether you wanted, say, mammoth ivory handles. And other specialty things get even more expensive than that.
I mean, the oyster knives are beautiful with the koa wood and all these other exotic woods in them.
Thank you.
So, Adam, you had mentioned how a barber will be stropping his straight edge razor with a leather strap. How does knife making and sustainability and razor blades intersect, or do they?
Oh, they do. And it's a profound thing that a company like Gillette, for example, it was brought to my attention by a fellow who had worked there. And this is now maybe going on 10 years ago, that they put in 6 million pounds of steel into disposable razor blades every year, and that's steel that ends up in the trash.
Not recyclable either.
Not recyclable, no. I mean, have you ever tried to yank those little blades out of a disposable razor blade?
It could be painful.
Oh, it's brutal. And yeah, I mean, halfway there, I think, is the, what came before that design, the safety razor, which is using a blade that, it's a lot less expensive and you can use both sides of, and you could conceivably actually sharpen it if you wanted to. And then before that, the straight razor, which, I've seen a 100-year-old set of 7 that an English gentleman would have taking a shave from his valet every morning. And on Sunday, the valet would sharpen the whole lot and off he'd go again. So these things were mirror polished, maybe thousandths of an inch thick. The result is you have this more satisfying experience, and maybe you feel more connected to your face. I'm not sure. I think you would have to survive.
Yeah, that's one area that I, from a sustainability standpoint, I should make that leap, but
It's terrifying.
I have a little bit of a phobia about, like, maybe I've watched too many gangster movies where the guy's sitting in the chair getting shaved and you're just waiting for that little threat to come from from the guy who's replaced the barber.
Oh, God. Well, they say that if you could shave your knee all the way around without hurting yourself, then you're ready to do your face.
Yeah, but if you mess up your knee, right, you don't cut your throat.
A little fear goes a long way. But, you know, there was how long ago, and that was how men shaved. And so maybe that's why men wore more beards.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know why they started shaving.
Why?
Alexander the Great started shaving his troops so that they wouldn't get grabbed by the beard in battle.
Ah. I mean, I have a couple of straight razors that I've purchased at flea markets and I've faithfully rehabbed and got to so they will take the hair off my arm with a whisper, and I still have not managed to muster the courage to try it on my face, but I really promise I will.
Folks can go see Adam's beautiful work at mksdesign.com. Adam Simha, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Pakman. He's the host of The David Pakman Show. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So are there any of the 16, 17, 18, I've lost count, of the GOP candidates who have embraced the reality of climate change?
Yeah, Carly Fiorina, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, has said that not only is climate change real, but there's every indication that human activities on Earth are a factor in that. She seems to just not be saying anything too outrageous. She's just saying, hey, this is the scientific consensus if you look at it. Ben Carson sort of maybe thinks that human-caused climate change is a real thing, but he sort of seems to think that it's irrelevant. He thinks that we should be using, quote, our God-given resources to do whatever it is that betters our day-to-day lives.
Says the man of science.
Says the man of science. John Kasich has an unclear position. He said sort of conflicting things. Rand Paul says that the science is inconclusive, which is also Rick Perry's position, although Rick Perry is also gone. And interestingly, Chris Christie, who is one of the more moderate Republican candidates, he does believe that global warming is not only undeniable, but that humans do contribute to it.
And where has Marco Rubio come out on the issue of climate change?
Well, Marco Rubio had the opportunity to vote for congressional legislation that acknowledged climate change was a real thing and that human activity is a factor. And he voted against that congressional legislation. And a couple of years ago, he told the Tampa Tribune that he just doesn't think there's yet enough scientific evidence to justify the belief that humans are impacting the climate. So he is in the side who thinks it is either false or that the science is inconclusive.
And does Donald Trump have a climate-denying streak in him? And what can we glean from the Donald in terms of his stance on the environment?
Well, he's been pretty clear in saying that he believes his term was global warming is a hoax created by the Chinese so that the U.S. would not be competitive in manufacturing. Of course, actual scientists have dismissed that as absurd and completely baseless.
How would the Chinese have done this exactly? Does he give us details on this conspiracy?
No, I mean, like most of what Trump says, that it lacks in specificity. He also says that the Obama administration has thrown away billions in failed green energy projects, which he also sees as connected to this sort of broader hoax. But I think the internal logic of it would be that if the Chinese can successfully trick the U.S. into not only thinking that climate change is a problem, but that it's related to manufacturing activities, they could sort of in a clandestine way make it so that production decreases in the US and therefore give more manufacturing business to China, which is, correctly and accurately, China is a really big polluter. And that would sort of be the way where they could take business, manufacturing business away by tricking the U.S. into dealing with a hoax that Trump describes as climate change.
Getting back to Carly Fiorina, she hasn't come out with any kind of solution to the problem or acknowledged that we need tough regulations in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, right?
Well, she has said that even if at this point we shut down all production in the United States, that the science would still be what it is today and that we already have a sort of damaged broader environment. So she thinks that there needs to be a global effort, that it will cost money and that it will take decades. I haven't read anything more specific about exactly how that would be carried forward, though.
But not just Carly Fiorina, but have there been any candidates that have come out specifically for, let's say, a cap and trade or a carbon tax?
Chris Christie has been pretty specific about CO2 levels and greenhouse gases. And the only issue is that he has not yet seen a link. His big thing has been Hurricane or Superstorm Sandy in New York and New Jersey as governor of New Jersey. And where he seems to sort of get caught up before suggesting specific remedies or a path forward is that he's not convinced that the climate change he believes to be real is causing these major weather events. And I don't know, he sort of just seems to get lost in that. And I have not heard anything specific. That doesn't mean it hasn't been said, but in my research, and I try to follow this pretty closely, I've not heard anything about certainly carbon taxes from Republican candidates.
Let's talk for a second about the vilification of the EPA. This is an agency that was founded by Richard Nixon and did great things to clean up our air and water through the 70s and the 80s, but now it's being looked at as a nice talking point, almost a pinata by the GOP candidates. Where does the antipathy from the EPA start? Is it purely just big business has funded these candidates and so they've decided to lash out at the EPA? It seems like this resonates with the Republican base.
It's always important to follow the money the way you're suggesting, but at its core, opposition to the EPA among the right is sort of based in the idea that business should be regulated as little as possible, that business and thus Americans do better when regulation is kept to the absolute bare minimum. And the sad reality is that there are problems at the EPA, but the problems are at the EPA are in specifically the EPA being hamstrung and not able to do enough regulation. And as we see time and time again, we see stories turned upside down. There was recently a river that became more polluted after the EPA went in to start a cleanup, and Republicans were very quick to just blame the EPA for the problem. What really caused the problem was lack of regulation initially of private industry, which recreated the situation that forced the EPA to go in. So there are problems with the EPA, but the reality is that we need more regulation on business, not less. And the reality is that in the midst of the job creation that we have seen under President Obama, the job creation has happened exclusively in private industry, and public jobs have actually decreased under President Obama. And it's very strange, although it's not really that strange, that the right has not praised President Obama for shrinking the number of government jobs. This is something that most Republican candidates, either directly or indirectly, say they would do. President Obama has done it, and we only hear that we need to be eliminating agencies wholesale from the right.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to David Pakman. He's the host of The David Pakman Show. So let's turn to the Democratic side of things. Just like the GOP litmus test for the environment is to generally deny climate science, it's kind of the opposite on the Democratic side of things. You're not going to find a lot of Democratic candidates who are climate change deniers. But are there any major distinctions between the Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, and Hillary Clinton stances on the environment that you've been able to glean?
Well, there are some differences. And, you know, sort of to set the context, you're right. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, and Lincoln Chafee all believe the science on climate change, and they believe that human activities on Earth are a factor in changing the climate. Hillary Clinton recently stated her opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. This is in contrast to Bernie Sanders, who has loudly stated opposition for a very long time. And immediately after that happened, critics of Hillary Clinton were quick to point out that this is a new position for her on Keystone XL. Now, we could say, well, as Secretary of State, she was sort of in a different position. She couldn't really just say what she personally thought, and people have equivocated. But at least with regard to where they stand today, the policies of the Democratic candidates are quite similar.
Do you think that the swerving to the left, if you will, by Hillary in terms of Keystone was her just being pushed by the Bernie Sanders surge as of late? Or do you think this is what she really believed and was kind of keeping her opinions close to the vest while she was still Secretary of State?
It's very difficult to know what someone truly thinks, especially when it's an elected official at this level. A few people have suggested to me that it's because of Bernie Sanders that she has had to, at this point, or at least has decided to, become clearer and unequivocating on certain issues like Keystone XL. I think it's really hard to say one way or the other, but what I think is, in either case, no matter why Hillary Clinton is now taking that position, I think it's great that before we even have the first Democratic debate, we've already established that the Democratic candidates are all on the same page with regard to issues that really should not be controversial.
It's going to be interesting to see where these candidates fall when it comes to fracking and natural gas exploration.
It is going to be interesting, and of course, my take and what I think is the long-term solution is going to not involve natural gas. I totally understand the arguments that are being made now as a transitional fuel, according to some, off of oil, but I think that the undeniable reality is everybody will be better off if we can go as directly as possible, right? Go directly to alternative renewable energy.
He's the host of The David Pakman Show. David Pakman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by O'Donnell Levy, Dire Straits, and Jaco Pastorius.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.